At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello and welcome to the Undercut Podcast. I'm your host this evening, Jesse Billington, and we're back to preview the 13th round of the 2025 Formula One season, the Belgian Grand Prix. To do this, I'm joined by Timo Albers-Daly. How are you?
Nice and relaxed after a surprisingly long feeling two-week race in Silverstone. It seems a lot longer. I don't know about you. I mean, I've had IndyCar keeping me company in the meantime, which has been fast and frantic and frenetic, but it's going to be nice to get back into some F1, even if it is a sprint weekend. You've still got to love Spa. How are you?
You've still got to love Spa. Spa will always deliver, and just got to get through the sprint weekend bit of it. I think, thinking positively about it early doors, the sprint weekend means there's less preparation, which means Spa is more likely to Spa than ever sparred before, because obviously the drivers will be approaching a circuit that they haven't had the chance to practice around quite so much. But we'll wait and see what happens. In the meantime, yeah, it has been a weird sort of two-week gap. Last time we were here, it was British Grand Prix. I'd been at Le Mans Classic. Since then, I've had Festival of Speed at Goodwood, and then my sister's wedding. So it's been just sort of non-stop for me. I'm not entirely certain if I'm on foot or horseback at this point in time, but still, we roll, and I'm aware that it's the Belgian Grand Prix this weekend, and I'm quite looking forward to it. More importantly, though, there has been some significant news since we were last on air.
And Emerson Fittipaldi's joining Formula 2.
Yeah, Emerson Fittipaldi's joining Formula 2. He's doing well for a 70-year-old getting into Formula 2. It's weird they're letting a Formula 1 champion return to Formula 2, but I guess he never won.
Well, he clearly watched the F1 movie and thought, well, if Brad Pitt, Sonny Hayes can do it at the ripe old age of 63 or whatever it was, then there's no reason that an extra 7 years should make any difference.
Emerson Fittipaldi, just checks notes, is 78 years old.
There's nothing that an extra... Let's just ignore how big the gap is between the two of those is, and he'll be fine.
He didn't win Formula 2, though, so technically he can go back to do Formula 2. He raced in Formula 2 in 1970 with the Lotus Semiworks team, Team Bardal, in a 59B. He 6 finishes in the points, 4 on the podium. He ended the 8-race season in 3rd place behind Clay Regazzoni and Derek Bell. While this result was very impressive for the newcomer to the series, the spotlight was on Fittipaldi that year because of his activities in Formula 1 instead. Because at the same time, he was also sort of starting to run in Formula 1 at the same time alongside Jochen Rindt and John Miles at one of the teams. So, yeah. Anyway, but no, we jest. Actual Emerson Fittipaldi we're talking about is Emerson Fittipaldi Jr., the 18-year-old son of 2-time champion. But we'll get to his news anyway. The important thing, which we almost skipped over there, is that...
I jacked you immediately there. Continue.
Yeah, you immediately sent me off on a bit of a fool's errand. The important news is that Christian Horner has been sacked from Red Bull. Obviously, we're late reporting this news because this all happened about 2 weeks ago, but we were recording then. And frankly, we weren't entirely certain what there would be to report and record at the time. And there still isn't a great deal to report and record, really.
It's the sod's laws thing of... If we had done an episode covering this, then a slew of news would have come out afterwards of all kinds of other shenanigans going on. But as we didn't, typically there has been nothing. It was all pretty much done and dusted in less than 24 hours, which was very intriguing. So many intriguing elements to this whole story that everyone and their dog would love to know about, and as many people keep saying, we probably won't know the full story until someone writes an autobiography in about 10 to 15 years' time, frustratingly, because we'd all quite like to know. We've all got theories and opinions on what might have been going on there, but we just don't know, and that's what's so intriguing about it all. There wasn't even an official line as such. It's just, he's gone, Lauren is stepping up, and Alan's stepping up at Racing Bulls. Continue with your week, and you're like, excuse me, you can't just do that. We'd like a bit more context, please, and thank you. Otherwise, we are just going to do what the rest of the internet is doing and come up with more and more far-fetched theories as to why you decided 2 races away from the summer break was the time to do this after him being in the role for, I think I'm right in saying, 100 years?
A very interesting one. We'll cover the immediately obvious bits. Obviously, Lauren Mekke's promoted from the team principal role in the Academy at RB to taking over running the team at Red Bull. Meanwhile, Alan Permain will now step up as team principal at RB. The important question as to sort of why Horner was sacked and sort of the lead up to it. He's been the team principal since their inception in 2005, so 20 years, leading them to 8 drivers' championships and 6 constructors' championship titles. But obviously, this all comes 17 months after Horner was accused of sexual harassment and coercive and controlling behaviour by a female employee. And he was twice cleared of these claims, firstly after an internal investigation was conducted, and then by another lawyer who dismissed the complainant's appeal. However, during this year, there was supposed to be a further investigation of this by another external lawyer and an external sort of HR and works practice firm. So potentially there is something that's tied to this, and I will touch on why I think that's important to note in a moment. The other part of this is potentially the fact that the Thai owners of Red Bull no longer have a controlling stake in the company. They've dropped to 48, 49% holdings, and they were huge backers of having Christian Horner leading the ship at Formula One, but now was no longer sort of key holders. They don't really have that say anymore. So it
And
seems
apparently
that
2% of the, I think overall 51% they used to have at the time was tied up in a essentially inaccessible location due to many a reason for doing that sort of thing. And the timing then was just very interesting that even if they'd wanted to do something about it, they couldn't have done because they didn't have all of the voting power available to them. So that again just raises more questions from the question without giving you any answers, really.
yeah, so sort of how those two that 2% became available or suddenly available to the right people,
Just inactive.
yeah, or swapped from inactive to active was an interesting one to sort of conceptualize. But the yeah, it's a strange one to sort of think about, and the timing is, I think, quite good actually, because obviously it gave Christian Horner one last chance to be the team principal for his team. Really, he's had it since its inception at his home Grand Prix, and then wave goodbye to it. Also, one of the Red Bull habits ahead of the British Grand Prix weekend is Christian Horner, who doesn't live far from Silverstone, throws a giant party for all the drivers and the teams. So he will have likely thrown that big party, and before he had a chance to put in the expenses claim for it, been sacked. So
I wonder how many people at that party will have known, because from the sense of it, and again, you kind of have to believe what you see until you are told otherwise, that he didn't know this was coming, which after 20 years is a bit of a kick in the teeth, because love him or loathe him, I think if you're in a position for that long in any company, quite frankly, never mind Formula One, you kind of deserve a little bit more respect, at least. You know, it's kind of, even if everyone around you decides to absolutely kind of Julius Caesar you, you still think just because he's doing things to the way that it's not to your liking doesn't mean you've got to then emulate that kind of behavior. You know, it's kind of, you've got the chance to be nice and polite and you go about the proper way of doing it, and at least then you can be, no one's going to accuse you wrongly or kind of or hold it against you rather for being nice about how you go about something. You know, it's kind of like, well, no one likes to get fired, but at least we did it in the nicest possible way to you rather than just, so 20 years you've been here, and a couple of days after the British Grand Prix, oh, by the way, you're fired, and that's going to be effective immediately, and we could have given you a heads up, but we didn't. And it just, yeah, the timing on that side of things, I give you, is not bad, because again, if you were going to have a last Grand Prix in charge of a team that you've been in charge of for the last 20 years, your home Grand Prix isn't too bad, and you've got 2 weeks until the next thing, so there's plenty of time for you to clear your desk out and all the rest of it. But it just feels a bit odd, a little bit like some of their driver changes in the past, is kind of just wait until the summer break. That would have been perfect time to go about it then. Now makes me think, and the point that you've made reference to in the notes here, is that is it part of the process to try and keep Max from leaving the team? And I'm not sure if I'd buy that or not, because I don't know if him leaving is enough of a draw to keep Verstappen, especially as wouldn't you rather, and again, speculation, but wouldn't you rather have someone in charge who is not the perfect person, let's say there is some disagreement between the two of them, but knows how to get stuff done, rather than go into just unknown territory? Because as nice and decent as Lauren Mekies appears to be, we don't know too much about him generally. We know his work history, but in terms of him being in this kind of a big position, it doesn't feel like a natural thing for him. Like Sauber to Ferrari that Fred Vasseur had, it doesn't feel like that kind of natural step up. It feels more like a, we haven't actually got anyone in mind for this, so we're going to put you in charge as kind of a caretaker, and then we'll get someone else down the line. And I just think that you're not going to fire Horner off a whim, but then surely you would have a plan in place, and it doesn't come across, at least just yet, from the public image that they've given, that they have much of a plan.
I think that there is certainly some aspects of a plan there. I don't think that anyone, I was surprised.
Do they have concepts of a plan? Is that what you're trying to say?
No, I think
Is
there.
that the kind of reference you're making?
No, I think they genuinely do have a plan with what they're doing with this. But I think when it comes to people outside Horner and the immediate sort of management tier at Red Bull knowing before he was fired, I think that was absolutely sort of hermetically sealed up until about half an hour before he gave that speech at Red Bull Technology Center and was then summarily dismissed. Because from looking at sort of the sources and from where I got the news about half an hour before it actually happened, there is always a consistent leak coming out of Red Bull, and B, it is a trusted leak. Every time that I've picked up on something and followed it, it's always come true about half an hour later or about a day later. There's always been an element of veracity to it that's chaseable. So which suggests that this had been absolutely sealed right up until the moment that on that Wednesday morning, there was a coffeeless meeting with Christian Horner, and they sat him down. Probably Oliver Mintzlaff sat him down and said, "You're done." And part of that, I feel, is potentially because of, as I said earlier, there is this sort of ongoing tertiary investigation into his behaviour. And speaking with James Vowles at the Festival of Speed, I had a number of interesting conversations with him actually over the course of an afternoon. And he said that he felt there were many reasons that led up to this, not just the slipping in the team's performance and the brain drain out of Milton Keynes, which suggests that there is definitely something else going on. But when it comes to that slipping of the team performance, that will have almost certainly been a crucial element to it. The fact that he has lost so many big names, he's lost Newey, he's lost what's his face over to Sauber. And
Wheatley.
Wheatley, that's it, Mr. Wheatley. And you look at the sort of the potential jumps that certainly we've seen at Sauber, the way that they operate and the way that they've sort of conducted themselves over weekends has changed hugely under Wheatley's eye. And we sort of begin to wonder, okay, these were the people that were potentially vital to how a Red Bull Formula One weekend worked. Maybe we can get rid of the guy that could possibly be a bit of a hurdle to progressing and moving ourselves back in that direction. So there's a lot of questions about it. I don't have any questions about Lauren Mekies stepping up. I think that someone who's been a race engineer, a chief engineer, safety director, and race director at the FIA, and then at Ferrari, he was deputy team principal. He's deputized and done this job before. It's not like he's coming into this completely blind, in the sort of the same way that we saw Aoki Matsu come in. But at the same time, Aoki Matsu moved up from chief engineer for Haas and has stepped into that role at Haas brilliantly. This isn't a job that you have to have done it before at a lower team to be able to come in and know how to do. This is a job that you have to be able to come into with a unique way of thinking. And I think the roles that we've seen Lauren Mekies inhabit before suggests that he's coming into this with a very well-rounded worldview, if that world is the world of Formula One. And he has spoken to some interesting drivers across his years as engineers and later again, people that he knows with inside the FIA and within race direction, and also within Red Bull. He's been in Red Bull for quite some time as well at different teams. So he knows the setup, he knows the gist of things, he knows who to speak to get things done. This isn't just someone they've plucked out of thin air. And the same argument can be leveled at Alain Permain as well, stepping up to RB. They
Oh
need
yeah, in
to.
that sense, it makes sense to put them in those roles. I just don't see them staying in them, if that makes sense. Because, like you say, nice and well rounded with all the background there for the pair of them. They know what they're doing, but it just seems to me as like they are both safe pair of hands. whilst we see out the rest of the season and figure out what the hell is going on. And maybe they continue after that, but I just think that they're there as the option to, if you do well in your roles, then there is the option to stay. But gives us time to have a look around elsewhere to see if there's anyone else who would want to come in and see what direction they want to put the team. Because as you say, they have lost so many people, and they're just, and those are just kind of like the big names that we see and hear about every weekend at the top of the food chain, never mind people at the back of the factory and all these sorts of things. And if Max still goes, then that's going to be interesting to see what direction the team want to go in there. Because without him in their team this year, they'd be bottom in the Constructors' Championship, and they've got to figure out a way to at least be prepared for that, even if it looks safer now for them. Let's just assume that they've got him to stay. You still don't want to find yourself getting close to that position again if you're Red Bull and being caught off guard. So I don't know. I just feel, and maybe it'll be nice for us to disagree for once, but I think it's just a way of keeping things as calm as possible. You've got two very safe pair of hands with these two running both teams and being able to go back and forth. Because obviously they work together at Racing Bulls, so they have a good relationship there. They can figure out who's best to go in Red Bull for next year, who's best to have as backup in case Verstappen still goes, who you bring up from junior formula if you need to make a change at Racing Bulls, and all this sort of thing. And in the meantime, it gives everyone else at Red Bull management time to figure out what the hell they're doing and prepare for that for next year.
I think Red Bull management know what the hell they're doing. They wouldn't have made this decision lightly, and they wouldn't have gone, "Look, we need to get rid of Horner. Who the hell do we grab to put him in? Fuck it, Mekis." This
Oh
will have
no, I feel like they would have made, they have planned that far, but I just don't think that it's absolute definite that those two are staying in those roles long term. It's kind of, obviously you're not just going to fly a horn on a whim and go, shit, who do we put in there? Oh, let's just grab one of the two people from Racing Bulls and shove them in there. I think you have a plan up until that point, but then you think, but then like I say, you either, you give him the rest of the season, you figure out if he's more than up for the job, which by all intents and purposes he's proven to be in many other roles and teams before, but maybe you want to try and do something else at some point. And that would be the perfect time to, over the winter break, and to bed someone in to have a bit of time to figure it all out.
But I think if you look at how Alpine have treated their team principals over the past 3 years, and the constant chop and change, and the fact that it's led to continually dire and direr results, whereas you
I'd like
look
to think Red Bull would have learned from that one, though.
at,
They're not going to do the same mistake.
they won't make that same mistake. So they will have Mekis and Permain in those positions for longer than we anticipate. They will be in there for 3 to 5 years, I think, will be the window we see them in for. Because if you look at the teams that have kept people at the top for longer, we look at Zak Brown and Andrea Stella at the top of McLaren. If you look at Toto Wolff at the top of Mercedes, if you look at the longer periods of time that we had sort of decent team principals at Ferrari, and if you look at the fact that we aren't considering Fred Vasseur to be the problem, he's been at Ferrari for what, two, three, four seasons now? But if you look at the fact that he's settled in and it's given everyone time to go, yes, he was the correct decision to make. Ferrari have moved their problem further and further up the train. We're now looking at the chap who sort of oversees Ferrari sporting endeavors and going, "I'm afraid you're now the problem." John something, I think his name is. So for if you look at the way that other teams do it with their team principals and see success with it, I cannot see Red Bull going down this path of chopping and changing them. But regardless, the big question is, was this done to sweeten the proposition of keeping Max Verstappen? Ultimately, it seems like it might not have been done with the express purpose of doing this, but Max Verstappen is likely now going to see out his contract until the end of 2027. So potentially for Red Bull, this buys them a couple of years, and this is the sort of crux of my theory of, okay, we've still got Verstappen, we've got people that know what they're doing leading these teams, we can start to piece everything else together again. And that's where it comes from. It's the bigger
It's,
picture, not just that case.
no, but I think that say Max stays and he sees it as contract. Yes, you've bought yourself some more time, but I still think you then need to at least investigate what I was saying earlier and explore what happens when you don't have a Verstappen or a driver like Verstappen. You can't assume that you're going to automatically find the next version of him or the next Oscar Piastri and then just build a car around him. You need to be prepared for if he decides to split. He can do whatever he wants at the end of the day, Max. And if he just decides at some point before the end of 27, for nothing to do with any racing, he just wakes up one day and does Niki Lauda and goes, "Now I'm done. I'm just don't want to do this anymore." Then they've got to be prepared for that. And I think that would be, if they're going to keep everything stable, that's great. And I hope then that they look and learn from how close a calamity they could have had this all gone in a slightly different way, and make sure that they've at least got some plans in place for that.
We'll see how it spins out, but as it stands, it's currently speculation. I think we're immensely divided on it and really won't reach any point of sort of conclusion, even if we argue for another 20 minutes. As we've already alluded to, though, the second piece of news is Emerson Fittipaldi joining Formula 2, but instead it is Fittipaldi Jr., the 18-year-old son of the two-time champion, who'll run with AIX for the 2026 Formula 2 season. I caught up with him about his new seat at the Goodwood Festival of Speed.
Can I get a quick one for press? Obviously, absolutely. Formula 2 seat confirmed for next season.
Yes.
What does it mean? What's the ambition for next year?
Right. All right, sure.
Yeah.
Oh, you're recording.
Just
okay.
A voice note. That's all right. Yeah.
Yeah. Big news, and will be very good for next year to learn a lot, and with very talented and high-skilled drivers, and will be just an incredible opportunity to be really close to Formula 1, and the Fittipaldi name getting closer to Formula 1.
Yeah. And obviously, AIX, pretty competitive team as well at the moment. Are you keeping a close eye on the season as it develops?
Yeah. I'm working with them a lot, going to the tracks and the engineering meetings, and keeping a close eye at the drivers. Joshua's doing an amazing job. And the team is there.
Yeah. And obviously, we're here at Goodwood. Chance to drive one of the family cars. Yeah. What does it mean to get in something that special?
It's a dream come true for me. And it's also my first time ever driving a Formula One car.
What a special way to do it.
It's still Can't a Formula it. One car. Doesn't matter what year it is, it's still a Formula One car.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. So yeah, it's just an incredible opportunity. I might get to drive this later in the weekend, the turbine.
That's I also wanna such be, a fun piece of gear.
I want to be that type of guy to say, I have driven already a Formula One car with a turbine engine. But not
one,
only just a Formula One car.
But one of the turbines.
The only one in the world. Yeah. So this would be an incredible opportunity and lots of fun here.
I was going to say.
Doing what I love.
Driving Formula One cars. Goal.
Amazing.
Thank you.
So it's exciting news. Obviously, we've got sort of new drivers arriving in Formula 2, coming from different pathways. Fittipaldi currently running in Freca, I think, off the top of my head. So we're seeing these drivers emerging from these new pathways. Freca really emerging as this sort of proper possible opportunity for drivers to move into Formula 2, which is important when you consider that Freca is sort of becoming a bit of a dumping ground for Formula 1 Academy drivers as well. It's showing that this pathway from Freca into F2 is a viable one, and obviously Kimi Antonelli, a bit of a sort of golden boy poster child, early sort of icebreaker for that project. But if we see drivers that are able to make a success of this, it's a veritable statement. And speaking of Freca, Freddie Slater is back this weekend in Formula 3, stunned in his brilliant debut outing in Bahrain earlier this year. It'll be exciting to see what he can do this weekend at a circuit that he quite probably knows well. Currently leads Freca after 5 rounds and returns to Formula 3 with Hi-Tech. He previously ran with AIX and therefore fucks up my big spreadsheet, so I'm going to have to add numbers into different locations. But it's great to see Freddie Slater back, and obviously we both enjoyed his outing in Bahrain.
I'm hoping we get mixed conditions now, just so I can see what he's like in those. Because if it's dry, everyone else is in trouble. But as we saw in Bahrain, there was one driver that could stop him, and that was only because they ran out of laps for him to catch him. He was catching him at an absolute knot of rate. So if it's those sorts of conditions, I would be putting some money on him to do very well indeed. If it's mixed, and he does a bit of what Kimi Antonelli did at Silverstone last year in Formula 2, that would be quite something. And I think then, just to hark back slightly to the Red Bull story, you'd be going, we might want to investigate that, because as I've been talking about Slater with a few other people, he's not associated with any teams. And I think that's because maybe quietly, confidently, he knows what he's capable of, and he knows that if he waits around long enough, he can probably have his pick, and he can see what happens next year with F1 in 26, because he's still far enough away from F1 to be able to take his time a little bit. You know, he's only just dabbling in Formula 3 now. Let's say he goes Formula 3 next year. Let's say he only spends one season there and they go straight to Formula 2. soonest he's going to be in F1 is 28. By that point, you'd have seen how the regulations pan out. You'll know which teams are doing well, which ones are not doing so well, where the potential is, what's going on. And as long as he keeps doing what he appears to be doing at the moment, which is just knocking everything out of the park, then he could probably do whatever he wants and not necessarily follow in White Piastri's footsteps, but he could also do that of like, oh, this team signed me up, but then this team's come along and given me a very excellent offer, and you know what? I didn't think I'm going to take it. And hopefully they have better PR than Alpine did.
Yeah, I think if we look back at Slater's career as well, he definitely knows the left and right turns that make up Spa. If I flick back as far as his career, literally earlier this season, in GB3 championships, they have already had a weekend at Spa. Would you like to know how he finished those races?
I'm gonna say he did quite well.
Yep, a ninth, an eighth, and then a first. So pretty good. I can't remember how GB3 runs their season as to where he would have had to have qualified to get those. Potentially those first two rounds are sprint races, which might reshuffle the order at the top. I can't remember. Let's have a quick check of the rules.
Also an interesting note that he's then allowed to race at Spa, whereas if he was a permanent driver also racing in Freca or GB3, he might not be allowed to, because we saw that last year or the year before with a couple of drivers having to sit out a round or two because they'd raced at one or two venues but hadn't asked permission from the FIA if they could do that beforehand, which was the key element there of, if you do it without asking us, we won't let you race here in the big boy league. But if you do, probably be nice to you about it. So I wonder how that applies for guest drivers. But I also think that if you did need to ask, Slater's got a good enough team around him to double check the fine print.
Yeah, it seems that Slater has probably asked and made sure that it is permissible for him to do that. So, like I was saying, ninth, eighth, and first. Race three in GB3 is reverse top 12, so he will have obviously sort of capitalised on that quite nicely. And he's also raced there already this season in Freca, where he finished first and then unfortunately retired in the second race. And I don't know if they do reversals there, but yeah, he's currently leading this year's Freca Championship, 168 points, leads 148 from Matteo Di Paolo. So having a very good time of things indeed. It's going to be interesting to see what he can achieve moving forwards. Moving on from the news, we obviously approach the Belgian Grand Prix. Have we got any Belgian Grand Prix fun facts this weekend?
Just that Lewis Hamilton is one victory away from equaling Schumacher's all-time record at the circuit. Senna is obviously on the same number of victories as Hamilton, less likely that he's going to be beating that anytime soon. And Kimi Räikkönen is the most successful driver in recent times, scoring 4 victories in 5 years over the course of part of his career, obviously not the latter stages.
Yeah, I think that Hamilton also has, a bit like Silverstone, a really phenomenal record for sort of finishing, like, I don't know if it's top fives or podiums at Spa as well. So he's got a good record here and knows the circuit well. So it'll be interesting to see whether or not he can coax a bit more performance out of that Ferrari. He was close at Silverstone with a fourth. Maybe Spa will come to him. We'll touch quickly on the silly season tracker. Obviously, we've already mentioned bits. Verstappen to Mercedes is pretty much dead in the water as it stands now, which also means that Russell and Antonelli have actually earlier today been confirmed by Toto Wolff as sort of the drivers they'll be looking forward to going on. Alpine is still a bit of an odd one. Bottas to Alpine still seems like a strong idea, though it's entirely uncertain. Perez to Cadillac, probably the most likely one that I've got my eye on at the moment. Everything else is just a bit of a sort of mixing pot of guesses and rumour coming out of the paddock, so we'll see how it turns out. Something more concrete, though, is our predictions for the Belgian Grand Prix. And we'll start with pole position predictions, please, Timo.
Pretty shaky segue. I don't know if our predictions are on solid ground to be betting on in silly season, but we'll see what happens, I suppose. Pole position, I think Lando Norris. He's on good form at the moment. And I think that it will at least continue into Saturday, if not into Sunday.
It will continue into... Yes, yeah, because they sprint, then they qualify, don't they? Yes, I remember. I think Oscar Piastri will come into this fired up, and he's still got the championship lead, but it's closer than I think he'd like it to be. So he'll be firing on all cylinders and really looking to make a good show of things this weekend, and a solid pole position entry will do him nicely. Meanwhile, when it comes to the podium, Timo.
Piastri will then convert his not pole position into a win. And we're talking about Lewis Hamilton. I think just by sheer gumption, he will find himself in second place by the end of the Grand Prix. And then Max Verstappen will do Max Verstappen things and sneak his way into third place. He also does fairly well around here. I think he's got three victories. He obviously knows how to shimmy in and out of traffic pretty niftily. And yeah, I think the Mercedes, the Ferraris, Norris, and Tsunoda, they can be in, well, maybe not Tsunoda, but the rest of them can all be in amongst it. But I think even with the powered car, he's still going to put up a pretty good fight, a little bit like Albon can do at certain tracks and just make his car incredibly wide, much like Albon did at Spa a few years ago, I think, and just keep people behind him that way. So I think that's how Max sneaks onto the podium. Either that, or everyone's too busy fighting themselves behind that he's just in third going, I'll just keep my head down here and do my best Kimi Antonelli impression from Canada.
Yeah, it'll be an interesting one to see how he performs. I think we're going to see Piastri convert that pole position into a podium. Lando Norris will chase him down for second place, and George Russell will get back up onto the podium after last year's attempt, but hopefully he'll cling on to it this time.
Well, he was on the podium last year.
He was on the podium, but it was sort of stripped off of him afterwards, however. So I think that we're going to see him have a better run of things this time round. Meanwhile, when it comes to fastest lap, we're in agreement with this one.
Yeah, I think Oscar Piastri. Like I say, he's still going to be fired up one way or the other, and it's a shame we don't get a point for that these days in the championship itself. Obviously, we still do if we get this right, but yeah, Piastri, fastest lap.
Nice. Piastri, fastest lap as well. I think he's on such good form at the moment, it's sort of silly to not count on him, especially when it comes to that sort of last part performance. Wild predictions, though, and this is where things get a little bit interesting. Timo, we'll start with yours.
Not necessarily the most wild from the start of the season, but given their latest run of form, potentially wild. So I'm going to say double Williams points. It would be nice for them to bounce back just in time for the summer break so they can go into it with a positive mindset. We've gotten so used to them doing well that this recent bout of misfortune has seemed very uncharacteristic and hopefully not a sign of things to come and hark back to yesteryear. So I don't mind where in the top 10 they both finish, as long as they both finish inside the top 10.
Excellent stuff. I'm going for a similar prediction, double Alpine top 8, but mostly on the grounds of every time I try and predict like a team does a double, something horrendous befalls them, and it's Alpine's. I'm sort of trying to work out my powers if I can sort of sacrifice Alpine to see if I can use this to benefit a team that I do prefer a little bit. So I'm sort of...
Williams.
I didn't say that because if I say it, it might not come true. But we're gonna see what happens if I try and play with my powers in that direction. Otherwise, that's all we've got time for on this week's episode. We've somehow sort of wrapped that up in quite neat order. We'll be back with a review of the Belgian Grand Prix. In the meantime, though, Timo, where can you be found?
Find everything that I do because there's a... awful lot of it over on Instagram, t.elvis.daily.onthecurves for everything there. I've got some new interviews coming out written form over there. I've got some new episodes with some video interviews coming out as well. I've got On the Curves IndyCar because we have had a busy time there, as I've been alluding to earlier at the start of the podcast. And I've got some written work for the Paddock Chronicle as well. So keeping everything ticking over very nicely indeed.
Excellent stuff. And if you want more of me, you can, of course, find me writing for Classic Car Weekly. Pick up the latest issue. It's out now. It's a good one. You can also find me on the Classic Car Weekly podcast and, of course, on social media at Jesse on Cars on pretty much all platforms. There's always pictures, TikToks, videos and stuff appearing there. Well worth checking out. Otherwise, like I said, we'll be back with a review of the Belgian Grand Prix in a few short days. Thank you very much for listening.